Good evening, and welcome to a special May 22nd meeting of the City Club of Eugene, a U of O Department of Architecture Lecture Series program, and also the spring installment of the 2014 Design Excellence Lecture Series, brought to you by your local chapter of the American Institute of Architects. We are absolutely thrilled to be presenting this program from the Soaring Theater at the Holt Center tonight, and we're looking forward to an evening that continues to celebrate design excellence right up until sundown and after. My name is Karin Knudsen, and I'm the director of this first year's Design Excellence Lecture Series. I'm also a City Club member, an adjunct faculty member at the U of O School of Architecture and Allied Arts, and a member of the AIA Southwest Oregon Design Excellence Committee. I want to take a moment especially to thank our committee members, people working hard to put events like this together, and also to thank our generous sponsors, who are the U of O Department of Architecture, Lane Transit District, and especially Paul Destrid, who's made it possible for us to come to you from the Holt Center and the Soaring Theater and has donated this venue both for this lecture and for the Design Awards dinner that will follow. So thank you very much to all those sponsors. And we are so fortunate to have Carol Coletta here with us tonight. Carol is the Vice President of Community and National Initiatives for the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and she traveled from Miami to be here with us. She visits cities of all shapes and sizes all over the country to talk about and study what we can do to better support the vitality and livability and quality of the places that we live. And two simple words that Carol wrote about last fall made us absolutely certain that she was the perfect person to join us here tonight. And those two words were, quality matters. It's a big part of what has brought us here together today. The Design Excellence Program is a volunteer-led effort to support an ongoing community conversation about the value of design and also about the importance of quality in our built environment. Because what we do and how we build matters. It has an immediate and lasting influence on our community and how it grows and how it sustains itself. But it also matters because it influences the health and vitality of our community, and it shapes our lives every day in ways that we notice and ways that we don't. It shapes the lives of our families and our friends. And with that in mind, design excellence is absolutely the goal that we should be after. But I will offer that we've heard a fair amount in the last year about this term, excellence. And a lot of people have asked if maybe we might want to reconsider and name the program something a little bit less aspirational, you know, just sort of take it down maybe a notch. And it was an interesting conversation we've had in every case, because it's easy to get the wrong impression when you're talking about things like excellence. And it's also maybe a word that could make people nervous. I've heard people say that it sounds elitist. I've heard people say it sounds naive or foolhardy. And also, maybe worse or worst, that if we hold higher standards for our community, we're not going to get anything. And it wasn't until yesterday, maybe, that I understood why it was that people might have those thoughts or might be thinking about those things. And I realized, perhaps, that it was because people were thinking of design excellence as a noun and like a thing, an abstract idea, something that lands here from somewhere else, from somewhere out there. And to me, and certainly to all the people, members of the AIA and the people working on this Design Excellence Committee, design excellence is at its root a verb. It's something that we're working very hard to accomplish, and it requires quite a lot of effort from all of us. It's not going to land here from anywhere. It's going to come from the people who are here and who are working to accomplish it. And so Carol is here tonight to give us some more ideas about how we might do that. Widely recognized as an expert on the development of cities, Carol joined the Knight Foundation in 2013, and she was previously the director of Art Place, which is a unique public-private collaboration to accelerate creative placemaking in communities across the country. Prior to that work, she was also president of CEOs for Cities, which is a national network of urban leaders, and she served as the executive director of the Mayor's Institute on City Design. So please join me now in welcoming Carol Coletta.
Thank you. I want to talk about a lot of things tonight, but we're going to blow through this really quickly. So I try to follow along, and I'll do my best, because I want to tie a lot of themes together. And I want to start because, as you just learned, I'm with the Knight Foundation now. I want to start by talking about information, just for a minute, because I don't know about you, but you know, sometimes it's hard to wade through the news and what's real and what's not real. And over the last 12 months, there have been some really prominent headlines that you may remember. New doubts about the value of a college degree. The great debate, is college still worth it? The real reason college is a bad investment. Now, if you couple those actual headlines with stories of legendary dropouts like Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, you get the impression that college is for suckers. Yet, as all the research has shown, the new Pew study again shows, college is the best deal out there among full-time workers. The median salary for a college graduate is $15,500 more annually than someone even with some college or a two-year degree. Over a 40-year career, that's more than $600,000. And last time I checked, college still doesn't cost that much. A person with a college degree is less than half as likely to be unemployed or to live in poverty than a person with some college or a two-year degree. So who's the sucker? Or consider another popular headline. Crime is on the rise. Every night, turn on the evening news, chances are, no matter what city you're in, some crime is going to lead the evening news. I lived in Chicago for almost a decade, and honestly, if you're a regular reader of the morning newspaper there, the Tribune, the steady drumbeat of prominent crime stories could convince you not to leave your house. And you may have heard some of those stories about Chicago. So imagine the surprise of many of us when one contrarian blogger, probably someone who wasn't even being paid, last November reported the facts. Gun violence and murders in Chicago were actually down, way down. There were fewer murders last year in any year in Chicago since 1965. The total number of shootings, shooting victims, was also dramatically down, but no one seemed to know it. So, you know, now even one crime is too many crimes, especially if it happens to you, but the overall trend was absolutely clear. So two stories, two myths, two contrasting realities. I'll bet you could name a story from Eugene that would be exactly the same, another myth. So in the face of all of that mythology, what is a concerned citizen supposed to do? How do you make good decisions about how best to contribute to your community's success? Which idea is good, which idea is better, in the face of such pervasive misinformation? That's a question, again, we think a lot about at Knight because our founders were very successful newspaper publishers, and they believed that informed and engaged communities were essential to strong democracies. So among all the good things that you could do to make Eugene thrive, how do you choose? What do you support to get real leverage? How does 1 + 1 = 3? Getting the information right and getting the information to the right people, I think, are the first steps in making any community successful. But look, if you've been around as long as I have, and I've been around a long time doing this work, you can probably recount a veritable trail of tears of community decisions made on false, misunderstood, unexamined information like downtown will never come back. No one who could afford a car would ever ride transit. No one over 17 would ever bike unless it's for recreation only. Good design is too expensive. Maintaining an urban growth boundary will choke off our future as a community. The American dream will never embrace density and diversity. It's this kind of misinformation that keeps communities distracted and confused. Whether that's intentional, I'll let you be the judge. But I think it's really problematic. Because of our newspaper roots, Knight talks a lot about the media business being disrupted, and you've all seen that, particularly with in the newspaper business. But look, you all know that communities have been every bit as disrupted as the media business. The leadership structures are now different. I mean, when I started in this business, you know, you could get the right six white guys in a room and they could pretty much make any decision they wanted to. That's a joke now. You can't make decisions top down. You have to have broad distributed leadership to get anything going. If you don't, you're probably still on go. The demographics today are really different, and consumer trends, consumer preferences, particularly among young people on how they want to live and where they want to live, are dramatically different. Local economies and sources of local competitiveness are all different. These are not small changes. That's important for all of us who care about the future of our communities to understand. These aren't small changes. These are disruptive changes, and disruption always calls for innovation, for doing things differently. I think it also calls for focus. When disruption occurs, it's confusing, right? It's, you know, you're having to invent. So we need innovation, but we also need focus. We need to know where to look for leverage. It's interesting, again at Knight, we invest in 26 communities where our founders had newspapers, and all of those communities have very important differences. They have different strengths, they have different weaknesses, they are at different moments in time in their histories and in their trajectories. But no matter what their differences may be, they have one thing in common: the importance of talent, opportunity, and place. And I want to tell you why. Since the percentage of college graduates in any community's population explains 58% of its success, if you measure success by per capita income, it stands to reason that cities have to focus on talent. You are blessed to be the home of a major university and other institutions of higher learning, and that's nice because, you know, that in some ways sort of takes care of your talent attraction strategy. But I would say in today's world, if you don't have a talent strategy, you really don't have an economic development strategy. And because talent is mobile, the more education people have, the more mobile they are, the more likely they are to move from one community to another. And people under 35 move much more frequently than people over 35. It stands to reason that that cities should be particularly focused on young talent, not because it's hip or cool or anything else. It's because that's, if you need to attract talent, that's when you can attract talent. When it's young, if you're at risk of losing talent, that's when you are at risk of losing it, when it's young. So it seems to me, again, you've got the attraction figured out here in Eugene, but you have to worry about retention. I want to put talent aside for a minute, and I want to talk about opportunity, because it's that combination of talent and opportunity that I think is really powerful today in cities, and it's not something we've talked enough about, I think, particularly given the new research. Look, the foundation for creating opportunity in America, you know, I know, it's education. That's foundational, but it's not enough. I mean, educators can't do it all. And new research is pointing us to some really interesting new ways to intervene in terms of creating opportunity, or what I would call economic mobility, or as evidenced by economic mobility. And it's this. This is the thing that I think is really new And we need to learn it as fast as we can and start to act on it. And that's this. It turns out that people who live in economically integrated neighborhoods, in other words, neighborhoods where people of different incomes live in close proximity, those are the people much more likely to attain upward mobility, economic mobility, which I find fascinating because, you know, if you look at the way in which we built our communities, that's not exactly standard. So what happens, obviously, is when people are living near people who are different economically than they are, well, there are a lot of things that happen. You end up with better public services. You end up with stronger political advocates for the neighborhood. You end up with broader networks. You end up with more economic opportunity as well. And so I think that is we need to know that, and we need to act on it, because today we are not designing for economic integration. In fact, everything in our cities in America are moving in the other direction, save one great trend, and that is the move of young people back to the core city. That's our great opportunity. That's the market opportunity we have. You're seeing it in Eugene to spend this in and create a new opportunity. We don't site, we don't program the civic commons for economic integration. We don't zone for it. We don't regulate for it. So there are huge opportunities there. Because I don't know about you, but it seems to me that if where you're born dictates where you end up, if zip code is destiny, then the American dream, I think, is dead. And that shouldn't be acceptable. Let me say this. I think some people hear growing talent and increasing opportunity as contradictory or conflicting goals. That's not the case at all, because contrary to another misleading myth, people with less education do better when they live in communities with people with more education. All the research shows that. I think it's because of the opportunity that gets, or the economic opportunity that gets created. So no matter who you are, you're better off in a community with people who are better educated. So look, here's what we know. Quick recap. Talent is the best predictor of a community's economic success. Talent is mobile. Young talent is more mobile. People with less education do better economically in communities with people when they live near people with more education. Economic mobility is harder to achieve in America today, and it's harder still if you live in concentrated poverty or in economically segregated neighborhoods. So if you want to point to the two factors that matter most in terms of success of cities, I think you can do no better than to point to talent and opportunity. However, there's a third factor, and that's place. And we're beginning to explore this notion very explicitly of how can place be an accelerator of both talent and opportunity. And I think there are a very interesting set of questions there. That's why place, how you design it, how you program it, is so important. You know, our places, our communities need talent. The gettable talent is young. What kinds of places accelerate their attraction and their retention? Places with vibrant core cities and core neighborhoods. Over the past four decades, it's funny, this trend pops up, every couple of years. And so you think, it's a USA Today story today, and, you know, it will be here and gone. There's actually a four-decade trend that shows a steady increase in the relative preference young adults have for the CBD, the Central Business District, and the three-mile radius around it, what you would think of as the core city. In fact, college-educated adults today are more than twice as likely as other Americans to live within that 3-mile radius of the core. And that's it's a 40-year trend that just keeps accelerating decade to decade. 64% of college-educated adults today say first they choose the city they want to live in, then they look for a job. Women are more likely to say that, by the way, than men, and that's important because more women are college-educated today. 85% of millennials say they prefer urban-style living, and if you look at the numbers of where they're going, they're actually, you know, voting with their feet. That confirms the preference. So to compete for talent today, you have to offer the kind of lifestyle choice that young adults are showing a strong preference for. If you think about the best downtowns you know, paired with the best mixed-use, mixed-income, bikeable, walkable, transit-served neighborhoods with lots of street life, that's what they're choosing. And Eugene is certainly heading in the right direction with the revitalization of its downtown, with the blossoming of mixed-use projects, the bikes on your street, your bus rapid transit, all of that's really terrific because good places attract and keep good talent. So and I want to make sure you understand this is not like a nice to do thing, okay? So making a good place, investing in place, is an economic development strategy. It should be at the heart of your economic development strategy because talent has to be at the heart of your economic development strategy. So I just want to point that out. And then I think also, and I've made this point, good places play a critical role in the economic mobility that is central to the American dream. So, you know, I think one of the deadliest mistakes we've made in the way we build our cities has been this stack of public policy decisions that isolated poor people in poor neighborhoods. In places with concentrated poverty and high levels of economic segregation, your ability to overcome your circumstances of birth is made much, much tougher. So let me be clear. Economic segregation is fundamentally a disaster for all of us. I would challenge you as community leaders and activists and people interested in the future of this city to put everything that you're asked to support to the test of three questions. One, will this decision increase the supply of talent in Eugene? Two, will this decision increase economic integration in Eugene? And three, will we look back on this investment 10 years, 20 years from now, and know that we made the right choice for the common good? This will require paying attention. It requires taking a long view. And it requires having confidence in who you are as a community and what you want your community to be in the future. I think it will also take a commitment to good design. The way you plan and design your community, that's not what you do when everything else is done. It's not what you pay for when everything else has been paid for. I think it's the way you shape the most important attributes to your city's success. I think you're fortunate. Eugene is moving in the right direction. And, you know, don't take that for granted. I think you ought to double down on the momentum that you've built and have the courage to demand high standards. The people you want in Eugene, the people that you need to build this city, will find that refreshing. So I look forward to seeing the next chapter in Eugene and look forward to maybe a couple of questions. So thanks. Other questions?
So now we're going to take a few moments and have a few people bringing microphones around into the audience to ask Carol some questions. And we have a first questioner in keeping with our City Club tradition. who is Michael Fifield.
You're tuned to KLCC Eugene, 89.7, 90.5 KLCO Newport, KLFR Reedsport, 89.1, and at 88.1 KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, and on the web at klcc.org.
Thanks, Carol. Carol, when we formed the Design Excellence Committee, the basic premise was design matters. And we really were thinking, how can we promote vibrant, meaningful, legible communities? And one of the topics that you brought up tonight was the idea of talent, opportunity, and place. And you mentioned some of the things that Eugene is doing right now that seem to be very positive. But I also understand that you've had a chance to walk around the city or be driven around the city a little bit. Are there specific areas that you've seen that you think there are opportunities that we haven't really taken advantage of yet, and some things that would really make the city of Eugene much, much better than it is at this time?
Well, I've taken a bike ride, which was fantastic, but I think it would be completely arrogant of me to come in and say, oh, here's what you're missing, you know, off a two-hour bike ride. So I'm not going to do that. I'd be much more interested in what you think is missing, because, you know, I think, again, every city... Like I said, every city, I think, ought to be focused on how to drive as hard as it can toward more talent, more opportunity, and using place to do that. So, but that manifests differently in different places, right, depending on your geography, your landscape, your development momentum, et cetera. So I would say, you know, the local vernacular. So I would say that's a question I would turn back to you and others in the audience. What's missing? The only thing I think what I saw was terrific. I could do without the expressway on ramp, but other than that, what else? Anything else?
Rob Zako, City Club member. I'll follow up on Michael's question and phrase it maybe in a way that you feel more comfortable answering. Eugene is not Miami, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco. We're a smaller community. Mm-hmm. And the work you've done around the country, do we remind you of other medium-sized communities? And could you give us two or three examples of things that other communities have done that you think have been very effective along the lines you've been talking about?
Well, I think, you know, university cities that are built around universities often have a great advantage, right? So that, because it puts a lot of people, and I think you are particularly advantaged because you have proximity between your downtown and your university. I think one of the things I would continue to think about just to say is the more connection you can make between those two, the more legible the connections between or among, I guess, downtown, the university, and the river would seem like a no-brainer, but I'm sure you must be working on that because that's too obvious. Are you working on it?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I think about, in the oddest way, I think about Oxford, Mississippi, oddly enough, much smaller than Eugene. Think about Ann Arbor, Michigan, again, university towns that have done, I think, a terrific job of linking the university with the town and employing anchor strategies. I think you could look at neighborhoods in much larger cities. Penn, you know, the neighborhood around Penn that developed, now Drexel's trying to do the same thing. So it's interesting. I mean, even looking at Lane and the housing that has gone on that same block is very interesting. So it feels to me like bringing, the more the campus is looking outward, not inward, but it feels to me like you've already done that here. The more seamless the connections can be between the university and the city, I think those are the obvious things to do. What it's very interesting now looking at universities trying to hang on to their graduates in terms of how they will support the startup of businesses. I don't know if you're doing that here at the university, but it's all that is interesting. It will it pay off? Won't it pay off? I think it's still to be seen. But we're seeing a lot of universities now test that. So those are some of the things I would think of. But just the more connected it can be, and the more that development occurs between those places, I think that's smart.
Hi, Carol. Mark Schlossberg.
Hello, Mark.
Hi.
This is my bike partner.
Yes, it was a very nice bike ride yesterday.
We did.
Any day when it's like this, it's beautiful. So it's interesting that you mentioned better connecting the university and downtown, because there's really not a lot of connection. There hasn't been. The main sort of transportation connection is in one direction only. And in fact, making a better connection between the two has not really, from my perspective, not been on the agenda of either the university or the city until a group of students actually, about a year and a half ago, came up with a really robust idea to put a two-way transportation cycle track between the two to actually build up that corridor and that connection as a transportation, but also as an economic development kind of thing. Which brings me to my question, which is, in your experience in other cities, sort of, where's the leverage? Where are the places to push that type of change the best? And the slight backstory is we're in a very consensus-oriented part of the country that doesn't like conflict, and there's never consensus. So the default position is not to get anything done. So in an environment like that, is it political leadership? Is it are we waiting for economic forces to respond to this changing demographic trend? How can we accelerate that? Like, how do you put the disruption into the system that seems to default to a lot of inaction, despite all the great progress that we're doing, which is excellent? Some of us are impatient to see it go faster.
Huh. That's such a good question. And, you know, I think I wish there were a formula, because that would make it so much easier, wouldn't it? But there's not. And I think the disruption comes, and the acceleration of these things comes from lots of different places, depending on the community. I mean, my hometown, I live in Miami now, but my hometown of Memphis went from being the most, for instance, the most unfriendly cycling place in the world. Memphis, 700,000 people spread over 650 square miles. Whoever thought that was a good idea, I'm not sure. But nonetheless, I mean, it would be the least likely place to cycle. And yet a group of philanthropists and then neighborhood, one CDC, and then crowdfunding on IOBI ended up funding major bike connections. And then, you know, a guy no one had heard from for years, sort of an odd businessman, got the federal government to fund a cycleway across the Mississippi River from Memphis to on an old bridge. So who would have thought? I mean, again, a very different collection of people than if you look at D.C., where it came straight out of the planning office. In Chicago, came out of the transportation office of the mayor. So, you know, it comes from different places. I mean, it's interesting you ask, because we talked yesterday about the leadership initiative that you're putting together. Not putting together, you're running in 17 universities, which is terribly impressive. And we'd like to be part of that as part of an initiative that we call it the Leadership Initiative at Night. We're trying to figure out what is it about the communities that have been able to have major disruption and accelerate innovation in a very quick way? What did that look like, so that we can actually get some case studies and learn it for, spread those lessons if there's any continuity or clarity to that? We're just trying to explore. So that's something we're going to spend some time on the next 9 months. And when I find out, I will let you know. Because I really don't know. It's just my experience is different people. It comes from all different places, depending on the local. Where do you think it could come from here? It's okay. He could just yell it out. Where do you think?
Where
Yeah, you, personally. Yeah. Okay. Good. We'll talk more. I'd love to hear more. Okay. All right. Then I'd love to. Does anybody else have a question? One more question? We'll do one more back there, and then we'll socialize.
Marty Wilde, City Club President. One of the things, our university recently expanded, and one of the challenges has been what has been called the student housing monoculture. In the sense that student housing will take over a neighborhood as opposed to being integrated. Do you have examples of how that how neighborhoods can welcome students in but still maintain a diverse perspective? Because as I take your point well about the benefit of diverse neighborhoods, but the neighborhoods are resisting and the students want to do their own thing. So we're trying to look at strategies to encourage diverse neighborhoods.
Yeah, that's a really great question. And how much do you feel like you're limited by the financing that will come to make student housing real? I mean, sometimes you end up with monocultures because policy dictates it or financing dictates it. I mean, that's part of the problem, right? So I don't know what the incentives are or the policies are here, but I think that you're seeing, oddly enough, we've got examples in. I mean, some of it depends on who else, like the size of the neighborhood. For instance, we've got a lot of student housing in downtown Chicago, as an example, but there are a lot of other people in downtown Chicago. Actually, student housing led the way in the Loop. Some of what's happened in the last 5 years is you've seen a lot of overbuilding of student housing, in which case that's then been rented out to a broader market, sort of breaking up the monoculture. Some of the breaking up of the monoculture has happened because it needed to. That happened in Akron, Ohio, in downtown, where the university is actually right up against downtown, but they're not well connected. They put student housing in downtown. They overbuilt the market, clearly overbuilt the market, so others have come in. So sometimes, it's just great good luck. But that's, it's certainly... I think you're absolutely right to ask that question, and it's a good thing the university is doing that. So the more you can, I think, mixed income, diversity, density and diversity is I think, something you always, again, principles you should always work toward. So why don't we, you have an announcement?
Oh, well, we're still on air, so we have time for more questions.
Oh.
If there are a few more in the audience. Karen.
I'll steal a moment to ask one, and it's a little bit of a shift in theme, but I think very much connected to what you're talking about. It has to do with a recent conversation that I think that Knight has inspired around how cities can stay in their sweet spot. Kind of to give a little bit of context, I'm thinking of an article that was posted to the Knight Foundation's website that was about all of the work that goes into planning for change and planning for increased economic opportunity and better placemaking, higher quality neighborhoods, and on down the list. But that also with that, oftentimes there is then a shift in property values or demographics or really access to those improved amenities. And it was, I thought, fascinating because I think one of the points was around really seeking that sweet spot and how cities could stay there, how communities could plan to stay there. And I think it's relevant to Eugene because the reason so many residents and people here love Eugene is because of the niche we've carved out for ourselves as a community and the unique identity that Eugene has. People don't want for that to go away, but we do also want to create new opportunities. So I'm just wondering if you could say a little bit more about what Knight is thinking about relative to that theme or what you think about it.
Yeah, let me set up the context. When I was working at Art Place, we were investing in creative placemaking, and the question was always simmering underneath the work we did of, are you creating gentrification with your placemaking? So we decided that was a question that we really should explore. We needed to understand, and as we needed to understand the facts. This goes back to what I was talking about tonight. So we commissioned a study that looked at four decades of facts about neighborhood change, and we specifically we started in 1970. We found 1,119 neighborhoods that we would classify as high poverty. Average poverty rate nationally is 15%. So this was 30. These were neighborhoods or census tracts in the top 51 metro areas that had poverty rate of 30%, double the national average, 30% or greater. 1,119 neighborhoods. 40 years later, by 2010, 105 had gone from high poverty to average or below poverty. 105. It's less than 10%. In the same 40 years, in addition to 1,119 census tracts with high poverty, instead of finding 1,119, we found an additional 3,000 something, I don't remember the number, more than 3,000 additional neighborhoods that had transitioned from average or below average poverty to high poverty. So this is a kind of a long explanation, but I want you to understand how we got there. We were actually seeking context for gentrification, and what we found was another major myth. If you looked at across America, that's not to say gentrification and very rapid change is not occurring in some cities. It is. Cities with great development momentum. But the overall story in America is you're not seeing that kind of change. And instead of talking so much about gentrification, what we really need to be doing is talking about how do we bring new investment into disinvested neighborhoods, because so many more neighborhoods are changing for the worse than getting better. It's not exactly what we see, I think, when we look at cities. But when you look statistically at cities, that's what's happening. So I want to preface anything I say about how do you find the sweet spot to say that cities are always changing. Poor neighborhoods in particular are always changing, and people are constantly moving out of poor neighborhoods. It turns out that the 105 neighborhoods that did change, did get better, lowered the poverty significantly. The only way they did that is if people with higher incomes moved into the neighborhood. That's the only way. So that sets up a context for understanding what's happening overall. Now, to your point, which I think is it's a great question, and it's the tough one. I think in some ways what people worry about, gentrification is not a clear, there's not a lot of clarity around that term. It's used differently in different places. But I think it is more, and it's back to the point about the monoculture, it's about brands, it's around sameness in cities. And I think people see, you know, it's like people in New York, you know, oh my God, we've got four banks on, you know, we've got a bank on every corner. This is boring. This is not, it doesn't create a vibrant neighborhood. Oh, the neighborhood that used to be cool and in, you know, lots of independent shops and independent restaurants is now full of brands. I was walking down, I was in Georgetown this weekend, and I was walking down M, is it M or Wisconsin? Wisconsin? Which is the one with all the shops? Okay, nobody knows DC. Anyway, one of those streets, I get them confused. I mean, where 10 years ago, independent shops, right? Independent restaurants, very interesting street. Now it's all brands. It's like J. Crew and Designer Warehouse and things. It's like so boring. And I do think that's part of it. So how do you maintain this? Well, we were actually having this conversation this morning about Seattle. And there's that tipping point that I think it's like, oh, we lost it. You know, we had it and we lost it. You know, part of it starts with us, right? I mean, where do we shop? What do we frequent? You know, do we buy local? I think that's a big part of this. I think it's how wide are your streets? So how big is, you know, what footprint is the real estate? Do you have sales tax? If you do, the incentive by City Hall is to get more sales tax, which means get bigger retailers. If you don't collect sales tax, and that's not an incentive for elected officials, then they're happy to have small stores. You know, do you shop online? Do you shop local? I mean, it's really hard to maintain, but I like the fact that I think there's, just as there's this inexorable move toward the center of the city, I think the same thing is happening in that we are raising our sensitivity to what local and independent businesses mean, what makers mean to communities, what, you know, small batch work can mean in terms of making the city just a much richer, vibrant place to live. But I do think there's a policy element to this. There's a consumer element for sure. There's a policy element. And then there, I think, is a support structure for small businesses that in some ways can simply be about, you know, taking them seriously as part of clusters and how can they learn from each other. So I think those are all really important. Just, you know, the other thing is, it's why I hate to talk about examples sometimes, because it's like people see Millennium Park. Mayor Daley and I used to talk about this. People would come to Chicago, see Millennium Park, and say, we need to do Millennium Park. But the second Millennium Park is never going to be as good as the first Millennium Park. You know, his advice was always be inspired by the ambition of Millennium Park and then go home and figure out what you can do that's unique. And I think cities, like every other business I've ever been in, have a herd mentality. It's like, if it worked there, then we can do it too. Some of that is logical and good. I mean, I love the fact that people are doing, bike infrastructure and they're doing BRT, and there are ways, obviously, we can learn and share. But there are some things, I think, where you simply have to have the courage to say, we're going to be Eugene and not that city down the street or that city that's being talked about in Atlantic Cities or Fast Company or whatever publication you happen to read. And that's why I say it's so important to know who you are and where you want to go. If you don't, I think, you know, it's like any road will get you there, and you end up looking back thinking, what were we thinking? And too many cities have ended up that way. So I think it's just important to understand what is special about your community and then work to keep it that way. Understanding that change will continue to occur. All right, so do we have time for another question? I don't want to keep people, but then there's something about a radio program, which I was actually not clear we were doing that. I knew they were recording, but I didn't realize it was now. Okay, go ahead. Yes, and then there's one over here.
Oh, great. Hi, my name is Eric Gunderson. You just mentioned transportation issues. We recently had a speaker, Gil Penaloso, you may know of, who gave a very inspiring lecture about the power of transportation and diversity of systems to drive communities and make them healthier places. Could you talk a bit about the power of that to reach the three goals you've mentioned, place, talent, and opportunity?
I love Gil. We were together last week, and he's a Knight grantee, and we're very excited about that. In fact, he's doing a convening for us in June, and for anyone who wants to come, called it's the 880 Cities, the Doable City, which we're real excited about. And I was with Gil, actually, been with him 2 weeks in a row in St. Paul, and I got to hear him again. I've heard him many times, and he never gets old. He's such a fabulous speaker. I think transportation is, transportation makes vibrant cities possible. The right transportation makes vibrant cities possible. I think walking, biking, transit all underpin vibrant cities. I think it's hard to have them without good transit and good biking infrastructure and good walking infrastructure. So to me, you know, they're inextricably linked. And if you look at the kinds of cities that talented people, young people are choosing today, in fact, look at when they're getting their driver's licenses. You know, not at 17 anymore, not at 16, not at 17. They're waiting longer and longer and longer. How many people don't own a car today? Don't have an interest in owning a car? It's interesting. I was talking to, and the statistics are would bear me out, but anecdotally, I will say I was with my two stepsons this weekend. One of whom lives in Boston and is a consultant and doing well, and the other, but young, just a couple of years out of school, and the other is just graduating from Georgetown and will live in Washington, D.C. as a consultant. And we were talking about how they would choose cities and so forth, and it's very interesting. Neither son has one bit of interest, not a bit, in owning a car. None. It's like their attitude, and I think this is pretty pervasive now, their attitude is that would be such an inconvenience. So car has gone from convenience to one generation to being inconvenient for another generation, which I think is breathtaking in a way. And I completely agree about the inconvenience. So I don't know how you deliver, and to say one word about opportunity and transportation, it's how we think we're going to move poor people to, you know, farther out from core cities and have them, you know, and have any transportation system that to get them to jobs that makes sense is beyond me. I haven't seen it done. I don't think it will be done. And it's costly. It takes time. And we need to be looking again at how we can provide good, cheap, dependable transit to support our talent goals and our opportunity goals. And so I think Gil's right on the mark. I was telling someone today, yesterday, I guess, maybe we were talking about it, Mark, because he had a great line when he was in St. Paul. He said, you know, people, not in this city, but in a lot of cities would say, well, we don't need to provide bike infrastructure because, you know, I don't see any bikers. He said, that's like saying, I'm not going to build a bridge because I don't see any swimmers. I thought that's pretty good. I like that. So anyway, he's great. All right, one more question.
Hi, my name is Rob Innerfeld. I'm the transportation planning manager for the city of Eugene.
And oh, good for you. He's important. He's the guy to interrupt, yeah. Disrupt.
So, I want to sort of give you a challenge that we face and see if you have any insights. So if you look at the downtown core and surrounding neighborhoods, in most of the neighborhoods adjacent to downtown, including around the university and the Whitaker, over 20% of people bike to work. So we have really high rates of biking close in. And then we have more car-dependent neighborhoods, more on the outer parts of Eugene that are more, these neighborhoods, some of them are more low and moderate income neighborhoods. So let's say hypothetically that we have $1 million that we could spend over the next year on pedestrian and bicycle infrastructure. We could spend that on building the cycle track that Mark was talking about to connect downtown to the university. We could spend it on a bike share system. And I think both of those things are the sort of talent attractors that you're talking about. Or we could spend the money in these lower and moderate income neighborhoods that are more auto-dependent because they may not have sidewalks or safe pedestrian crossings to make those neighborhoods more walkable and bikeable. So do you have any insights about how we should think about that?
I think I'd need to think about that, and I'd need to know more about the, you know, the situation. Are they are the neighborhoods too distant for biking to work?
Well, you know, these days, about 15% of trips are biking to work. I mean, our work trips nationally. So, like, one of these neighborhoods is called Bethel, and I would say very few people there would ever bike to work, but one of the concepts we're promoting in Eugene is something called a 20-minute neighborhood. And so I think the vision for a neighborhood like that that's a little more outside of the core would be to make it more of a 20-minute neighborhood where people could walk and bike to destinations in the neighborhood, whether it's schools or parks or shopping or the library.
And those destinations exist?
Yes.
So, you know, I think that, I mean, I don't want to comment on which is more desirable or makes more sense. Again, I don't know enough about the situation to do that. But it seems that, you know, if you're building the, if you're doing 20-minute neighborhoods, if you're doing complete streets, I think that all makes sense. And if you have the destinations in the neighborhood, then it certainly makes sense to make sure that people have ways to get there that are alternatives to the automobile. If that's your only alternative, it's an expensive one, obviously, as you know. So beyond that, I don't know what to say.
Thank you.
Yep.
And I think with that, it will actually be our last question. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you, Carol, again, for being here this evening. And we'll see you out in the lobby of the Holt Center for a reception to continue this conversation. Thanks very much.